Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today's show is kind of different for us. We asked for your favorite ghost stories from across Appalachia, and boy, do you have some good ones.
He hears an unearthly scream, and something jumps onto his back.
And then one night, Zona's mother, she awakes, and she sees her daughter, a ghost of her daughter, at the foot of her bed.
And we'll travel to the Dingus Tunnel in southern West Virginia, where there's just something spooky about driving through in the dark.
This is far out.
I really hate it.
Oh my God, it's so creepy.
Up ahead, our special Halloween episode of Inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Halloween is just around the corner. I've never particularly liked scary movies. For me, I grew up hearing about demons, not ghosts. But I do appreciate a good story, and we have some fantastic storytellers here in Appalachia. This fall, we wanted to hear from some of you and find out what your favorite spooky stories are. So we teamed up with the West Virginia Folklife Program, where they have a special hotline for folktales and other folklife-related story pitches. One of the first calls that came into the hotline this fall was from a young woman in Randolph County, West Virginia, who had a story she'd heard about a ghost sighting, or what some folks call a spook.
Hi there, my name is Caroline Hoyle, and I was told this story by a man in Montrose, West Virginia. He recounted it as a story that he had been told as a child about his grandfather. The story begins in the early 1900s on the first cold day in autumn. His grandfather, then a young man, left his wife and children to make a trip into town for supplies. So on horseback, he rode 4 miles to the closest town of Elkins. While he was in town, he stopped for a drink, which landed him coming home much later than he expected. Now, this road was rough then, and it remains that way today. So when he reached the neck of his very own holler, he was very weary. And at the mouth of this holler, where it meets the road, there are these gnarled, ancient trees on each side, and their branches form a kind of canopy over the road. And right as the young man rides under these interweaving branches, he hears an unearthly scream. And something jumps onto his back. The thing is heavy and is sinking 2 sets of long claws into each of his shoulders. The horse thunders up the narrow road, going faster and faster. He struggles to stay on while trying to look over his shoulder to catch a glimpse of the great beast. But when he does, all he can see is a great black mass and 2 giant glowing red eyes. He is drenched in terror, clinging to his horse, when suddenly the road makes a sharp right, and the creature flies off of his back and straight up into the air. And before he can even breathe a sigh of relief for escaping this beast, he sees that his entire farmhouse, from floorboard to ceiling, is on fire. And his wife and children are nowhere to be found. And that is where his story ended. So, horrified, I asked, what happened? What was it? It must have been Mothman, right? A great beast with glowing red eyes that foretells a tragedy, right? He smirked at me and said, Mothman ain't real. That was a panther. You know, like a spook? And it was then that I realized that he hadn't been trying to tell a ghost story. He was imparting wisdom upon me that had been imparted upon him. It was that the horrors that we face in our own hearts are much more frightening than the Mothman.
We'll hear some more of the ghost tales you sent us in just a minute. First, a story about a spooky place in southern West Virginia you can experience yourself. An old single-lane railroad tunnel in Mingo County has been the subject of scary stories for decades. Molly Bourne ventures inside the Dingus Tunnel to find out what exactly makes the place so unsettling.
Shortly after I moved to southern West Virginia, I started hearing about the Dingus Tunnel. It's an old railroad tunnel, one of the longest in the state at nearly two-thirds of a mile long, cut through the mountain. It was built in 1892 for a stretch of what was then the Norfolk and Western Railway, and it became the main line until 1904. The town of Dingus was a pretty hopping place back then, but when the railroad changed its route, the trains stopped using the tunnel altogether. So in 1913, it opened to vehicle traffic, with just one narrow lane. Legend has it the place is haunted. Not everyone believes that, but most people can agree on one thing. It's pretty scary. The road to Dingus, like most in this part of the state, unwinds like a ribbon. There's little to no cell service. And the tunnel kind of comes up on you quick. There's a sign indicating something is a quarter mile ahead, but that part of the sign saying what exactly is no longer there. Then, there it is. The entrance is black, except for maybe the eyes of headlights. It can be a hot summer day outside, bone dry, but it's often wet inside the tunnel, apparently from leaks in the ceiling. The lights haven't worked in a while, so it's dark. Really dark. There's an etiquette to driving through this tunnel, according to locals. First you stop, you turn on your headlights, you check for other headlights, and if you see them, let the car pass. It makes sense, except when you can't see because of fog, or you encounter someone who doesn't know or doesn't care about the rules. If you meet another car in the middle of the tunnel, one of you has to back out. In April, I drove through the tunnel for the first time with my friends Teresa and Judy, both longtime Mingo residents. I recorded us on the voice memo function of my phone, so the audio quality is a little sketchy.
This is far out.
I really hate it.
Oh my God, it's so creepy.
You're
getting way far back. Somebody could pull in behind that.
Don't make her go faster. Scary enough as it is.
I'll put my brights on.
Good. Oh, that's far less scary. What I'm really afraid of is not the tunnel, but the dark.
Hey, why is he keeping his brights on?
You have yours on?
Why? Yeah, nobody's...
Don't run into the side of the tunnel. We're worrying about
you. Fine. You're freaking me out, Teresa.
Three people were killed in a train collision in the tunnel in 1905, according to an entry in the West Virginia Encyclopedia. In 1972, writer Huey Perry published his memoir on the war on poverty in Appalachia called The Cut Off Your Project, and he described the tunnel as a violent ambush spot. There are some wilder stories that have been passed down over the years. Here's historian Stan Baumgartner.
The trains were robbed. You know, people were killed. It's hard to say how much of some of this is urban legend and how much of it is truth. The tunnel itself developed kind of a reputation, and it's made it just the nature of it, of how dark and damp it is, makes it even scarier.
2 years ago, a crew of Mingo County residents set out to investigate paranormal activity in the tunnel for this quirky local public access TV show called Relate with Nate. For the two-part Dingus Tunnel episode, host Nate Siggers brought in a group that includes Sabrina the Mountain Medium and Brad Davis, a former local newspaper writer who's also a pastor.
What's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of Relate with Nate. You know, it's close to Halloween time. Ooh. So we found the spookiest place in Mingo County, the Dingus Tunnel. Yes, I'm in Dingus. It is true. So, Sabrina, have you ever been through the tunnel?
Yes, and I've had a personal experience, and so has my son, coming through the tunnel. Coming through from the other end, maybe 5 foot in, we both witnessed a gentleman step out of the wall and straight back in. This is maybe a couple years ago. Very thin, bald, no shirt, baggy brown pants, rope belt. Just a few seconds worth, but he was there.
Ooh, I got chills. So guys,
Davis wrote a story. And yeah, he wrote, they saw some stuff. Flickering lights, weird shadows. There was even an unexplained train sound. But one person who's not scared of the tunnel is Bob Wellman. He's 82. He's not a fan of Huey Perry's book, which he says is full of tall tales about his family and the place he was born and raised. Wellman estimates he's been through the tunnel at least 500 times. He played inside it as a kid. It was cool in the summertime.
Cows would lay in that tunnel. And if you went through in a car, you'd have to get out and run the cows up.
Wellman also used to get up to no good in there. He and others burned tires inside the tunnel on Halloween, filling it up with smoke. A few years ago, he met someone he said was being aggressive in the tunnel, and they wouldn't back up. He went around it and ripped the guy's mirror off. Then there was that night in the 1950s when he was coming home from a date in his 48 Chrysler. He broke down inside the tunnel for 45 minutes.
Ran out of gas in about 12, 1 o'clock in the night. I just sat in there till somebody come my way, and they stopped, and I waved one up. They pushed me out to this side, you know. But Lord, it'd been scary. I don't think it's scary. Never did.
He wasn't helped by ghostly forces, just someone passing through. Still, even after hearing from Wellman, I find driving through the tunnel harrowing. Wellman says his wife hates it too, and she and others go up over the hill and down a windy back road to avoid passing through. Maybe I'll take that route next time. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Molly Bourne in Dingus.
Up next, a story about a supposed werewolf sighting in Kentucky, a ghostly fiddler, and more legends, tall tales, and ghost stories on this special Halloween episode of Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Oh, the werewolf, oh, the werewolf comes stepping along. He don't even break the branches where he's been gone. You can hear his long holler from way across the moon. That's the holler of the werewolf when he's feeling blue.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
On today's episode, we're doing something a little bit out of the ordinary for us. We're suspending our disbelief. We don't have our investigative journalism hats on for this show. But that doesn't stop us from appreciating a good tall tale or ghostly legend. After all, telling and retelling these tales is part of our Appalachian tradition. Long before TV or the internet pulled us away from the glow of a spooky tale, oftentimes a well-told story was how our ancestors entertained each other or taught lessons to the youngins and kept the crisp chill at bay as darkness of winter approached. For our next story, we head to Beckley, West Virginia, where Roxy Todd caught up with local historian Scott Worley, who told his favorite spooky story from Raleigh County.
One of my favorite stories has been passed down for probably the last 70 years. And it's a story of the coal camps. And in southern West Virginia here, Raleigh County, there are scores of coal camps and coal towns. And they seem to just go from one to the other to the other. And most of them were connected by a rail spur. And each of the towns had hundreds of miners. And the story that has been passed down is that right after the Second World War, when the towns were booming, came to one of the camps a fellow by the name of Frank Easter. And Mr. Easter went to work in the coal camp in Cranberry. And as we know it, he was a solitary man. He lived in a small single miner's shack in Cranberry, very much kept to himself. He did like to come into Beckley, as a lot of the miners did. It was a couple of miles, and you could walk right along the rail track, or maybe even catch the train as it came through. He came there to have diversion, to possibly gamble a little bit, shoot some pool, and drink a little beer at the beer hall. Unhappy life. It's the only cause. Well, one night, 1947, a train is slowly going through. It's 2 a.m. on the tracks, right outside Beckley. They encounter a form of something burning on the track. The train manages to stop. They extinguish the fire. And upon investigation, they find that it was the body of Frank Easter. Nobody knows why he was laying on the track burning. Possibly because he was known to wear a long duster-type coat and wore a slouch hat, and he smoked a long pipe. Possibly something flammable was on his coat at the time, and he had passed out from his diversions downtown and caught himself on fire. Nobody really knows. What they do know is that area where the track crossed the ties stayed black. Snow would not stick to that area, no matter how deep. What's even stranger to the story is they buried Frank Easter in a cemetery up on the hill above the coal camp. His grave, no matter how deep the snow will never stick on his grave. Always melts away. But bring forward into the modern day, that area of the railroad track has been taken up. It's now a very popular walking and biking and hiking trail. But guess what? That same area, snow will never stick in the particular space where Frank Easter burned to death on the tracks. And if you look off to the right, off into the field, you'll see the ties stacked up. Some of them are blackened. Some days when you walk by, you see a form of a man wearing a long coat with a slouch hat, smoking a pipe, leaning or sitting on those ties. Or you may encounter him walking along the tracks. One night, as I was relating this story on a tour, one of the ladies stopped me and said, "I grew up near that area, and my grandmother used to always tell me, don't go walking those tracks alone, dear, because you might run into Frank Easter." And that's one of my favorite stories from the southern West Virginia coal fields. It's always been told the ghost of Frank Easter.
Do you ever get goosebumps telling that?
All the time. It's probably out of the 70-some stories that I've collected, it's probably one of the ones that really resonates with me the most, because I walk that track and I'm always glancing over at those railroad ties to just see if maybe I can catch a glimpse of Frank Easter.
That was Southern West Virginia historian Scott Worley. He hosts a tour in Raleigh County called Haunted Beckley. Worley reached out after he heard that we were looking for ghost story submissions. Another person who responded to our request was a Twitter follower, Giles Snyder, who also just happens to be an NPR newscaster and the very first host and producer of Inside Appalachia. Giles' uncle actually wrote a book about his family's history, which includes some ghost stories from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. One of his favorite stories is about one of his ancestors, Ida Laura, who died in a buggy wreck in 1907. As Giles' uncle tells the story, Ida Laura was killed instantly when her head hit a curbstone. Giles' uncle writes in the book that one of his cousins recalled having seen a ghost that she thought may have been connected to the death of Ida Laura. Here's Giles Snyder reading from his uncle's book.
Jean Schley recently told me an astonishing story, which she has always thought was an aftermath of the buggy wreck. The Big Snyder House on German Street, the house that Harry and Ida Laura built, was eventually sold to James and Rachel Hafer in the 1960s. The couple had five children. Their oldest was a daughter named Jan, and the next to youngest was a son named Carl. The two children were amazed to learn that each of them had seen a headless woman in a long white dress standing at the second floor landing of the main staircase in the house. The children couldn't imagine who it might be, but Jean believes in her heart of hearts that it was the ghost of Ida Laura Baldwin Snyder, whose head was crushed in the buggy wreck.
That was Giles Snyder reading a ghost story called Ida Laura from a book of his family's history that his uncle wrote called A Soldier and His Family. Next, we'll hear from a younger listener from Wyoming County, West Virginia. 11-year-old Audrey Steele is an aspiring reporter and occasionally listens to the show. One of her favorite Inside Appalachia episodes was a previous storytelling Halloween episode, so we asked her to record a spooky legend from her town. After talking with family, historians, and even reading up on a few books, Audrey settled on the story about the ghost of Burg Hammond.
My name is Audrey Steele, and I'm proud to be from Wyoming County. My grandfather told me this story when I was younger. He told me this where he lives in Bud Mountain, well, close to Bud Mountain, about this man named Burg Hammond. He was a peddler and music man from the early days of West Virginia, and he traveled from homestead to homestead, bringing news from other towns he had visited. Many were kind to him and very much enjoyed his visits. When he visited farms and such, housewives would take him in. She would look in his wagons for coil, thread, things to sew with and things like that. And for the husband, tobacco and fishing and hunting supplies. Burg Hammond was pretty popular in many towns. The time came when people started to take his visits for granted and just take the things he had with him. One day, he was walking up the mountain, which is now Bud Mountain, with his horses and wagon. He lay to rest on the side of the wagon, slipped off with his horses and wagons, and fell to his death. And now, if you go up to Bud Mountain, just ask Burg Hammond to play his fiddle, and he will, because he never turned down an audience.
I grew up just on the other side of Bud Mountain, and I never knew that, well, as legend has it, you can still hear his fiddle echo across the mountain on stormy nights. Matt Milligan sent us this story about something he says he saw while driving in Versailles, Kentucky.
I was driving home from work. It was 2 a.m., and it was like a moonlit night. The full moon was out, and you could see things kind of, sort of, you know. I mean, it was bright for a moon. So I was driving home, and on my way home, I drive past a castle. And in front of this castle, I saw something moving. So I slowed down, thinking it was like a hurt dog or something. And as soon as I got close to it, it stood up on its hind legs. And it was like 6.5 feet tall, and it had this wolf-like features. Like, it had a snout, it had the ears, and it had the fur, but it was huge. And so I had my windows rolled down, and where I slowed down to look at it, it snarled at me and it started barking. And I told myself, I am not in a Scooby-Doo cartoon. I am not going to take the mask off of this wolf. So I roll my windows up, and I just got the heck out of there. And like, to this day, that thing still scares me. Like, if I see something on the side of the road at night, I just ignore it. I'm like, no, I'm done.
This next story was recommended to us by a man in Charleston named Sean Casey. He told us that there were some stories about a theater in downtown Charleston, West Virginia, that's supposedly haunted. We reached out to Dan Cady, the managing director of Contemporary Youth Arts Company, which used to be based out of this theater, and where some strange sightings are said to have occurred.
The old thing about things going bump in the night, they pretty well went bump in the night every once in a while over there. It was pretty bad.
Do you ever hear any stories about where these bumps may have come from?
Yeah. It's not really stories. I've had kids in my cast look up in the balcony and see people sitting there. Mostly there's a little girl that runs across the balcony up there. That one's pretty friendly. There's a really nasty thing on stage, and I have more than one. I've had some really lousy experiences, bad experiences with that one, as has a lot of different adults in my cast. It's pretty spooky. It is really pretty spooky. And you know, there's a church in there now, and I wish them well, because I think probably a church might, you know, send all these people to rest. But when I left, it was pretty active. It really was. You could sit up in the balcony. On most days, you could sit up in the balcony and you would be able to hear old-timey music being played up behind you in the old apartments. That was pretty cool. And you could do that anytime. If we were still there, I could have taken you up there today and you would have heard it. One of the guys that was running the place, he was hired to watch over the place while people doing shows were there, and there were classes up there. So we had a guy back about 10 years ago was chased out of the place by I don't know what it was, but it really scared the daylights out of him. It really did, because he literally went running into the night. There were some terrible... It's a terrible place at times. 2 o'clock in the morning, you don't just hear footsteps, but you can feel the footsteps on the stage. It's really pretty present.
That was Dan Cady, a playwright in Charleston, West Virginia. The theater company he manages, Contemporary Youth Arts Company, no longer performs out of the Capitol Theater. They've relocated to the mall in downtown Charleston. Today on Inside Appalachia, we've been hearing from several of our listeners who sent us their favorite ghost tales. Next, we're going to listen to some of our favorite stories from an earlier Halloween show we originally produced back in 2014. West Virginia has some of the best settings for scary stories. Dark underground coal mines, remote forests. There are hundreds of remarkably bizarre, mysterious ghost tales that are set here in Appalachia. And there's often historical evidence for these stories suggesting they might have actually happened. Take the Greenbrier Ghost, for example. It's Scott McClanahan's childhood scary story. He's a fiction writer who grew up outside Raynell, West Virginia, just a few miles from the place where the murder of Zona Heaster took place.
Well, the story of the Greenbrier Ghost, let me see. I guess there's like so many different like variations of the story. I'll just tell like the story the way that I heard it when I was a kid. And the way that I heard it was a kid, there's this one girl named Zona who grew up kind of close to where I grew up. So there was this girl named Zona. And she was a farm girl, member of this farm family. And one day, this guy named Trout had come into the community, into the farm community. They get married, have a home of their own. He's kind of taken her away from the family somewhat, I guess. There's kind of a rift between Zona and her family because they don't get along with Trout. She starts becoming ill over the course of time. And the family knows this. And this takes place over the course of months. One day, Trout is at work, and he's a blacksmith in this community. And he sends a child back to check on Zona to make sure she's okay. What the child finds is that Zona is dead at the foot of the stairs of the farmhouse. So he runs all the way back to where Trout is doing his blacksmith work. Zona's dead, and they're going to prepare her for burial. But Trout won't allow the women of the community to help. He does it all himself. He dresses her in the dress that he wants her in. He places like a thick ribbon around her neck. And then during the ceremony, he sits at her head and won't allow anyone to come around the body. They take that as the fact that he's in such grief and such despair that he's weeping and crying over the body of his wife. The body's buried. Zona's family goes back to their home. Time passes, and then one night Zona's mother, she awakes, and she sees her daughter, a ghost of her daughter, at the foot of her bed. And the ghost says, "I didn't die the way he said I died. I wasn't just sick and passed away. He murdered me. He broke my neck." The mother goes to sleep. The next night, she wakes up again. At the foot of her bed is her daughter, the apparition of her daughter's form, saying, "He killed me. He murdered me. Help." The way I heard it, then, she goes and gets the sheriff, which maybe makes the story a little bit more plausible, too. She goes and gets the sheriff, who comes and stays in the home. And the ghost appears that night in front of the mother, in front of the sheriff. So the sheriff demands like an exhumation of the body. Dr. Rupert, a local community is named after him, is the one who does the exhumation, and they find through this process that indeed Zona's neck had been broken. She hadn't just been sick. She hadn't just been ill. Trout is actually tried for the murder of his wife. The mother comes and testifies in Lewisburg that this ghost of her daughter had appeared to her on multiple nights, telling her what happened. And of course they have the medical records from the exhumation to back her up, that the story is corroborated by the records of the exhumation. This is the reason why on the sign that they say, you know, this is the only court case in the United States legal history where a ghost has helped try and convict someone of murder. They rebury the body. Trout is convicted. He's sent to Moundsville. And while at Moundsville, he is a carpenter there. And he is building coffins for the convicts, for the prisoners who die. Many years later, he hatches this plot to escape, where he is going to build a coffin. Once one of the prisoners dies, he's going to place himself within the coffin, have someone nail him up inside the coffin. They'll take the coffin to the outside, have it buried in the cemetery of the prisoners who have passed on. He has also contacted someone who is outside the prison, one of his buddies, to come and dig up the coffin so that he can escape. And that's exactly what happens. They have a burial of one of the prisoners on the date and on the time. The friend is there. After everyone is gone, he comes, digs up the coffin, and Trout is free. And then from that point on, nobody knows what happens to Trout. He just simply kind of wanders like a ghost himself.
That was writer Scott McClanahan telling the legend of the Greenbrier Ghost. The small town of Middleway, West Virginia, in the Eastern Panhandle, is home to about 450 people. Many of these families have been in this town for generations, dating back as far as the 1770s. Visitors who stop in Middleway today might see symbols of a pair of scissors and half-moon crescents on various signs, buildings, and even homes. These symbols come from a legend the town holds dear that dates back to the 1790s. It's the legend of Wizard Clip. Pete Fricka is going to tell us more about this famous legend. Peter was born in England and moved to West Virginia in 1989. The story begins with the farmer from Pennsylvania looking to start anew in Middleway.
The story really begins in about 1780, when a man by the name of Adam Livingston, living in Pennsylvania, a staunch Lutheran with a large family, started having some problems on the farms. And his farm, his barn burned, he lost cattle, his crops failed, and he decided that maybe he should try some new land, and so he moved south in about 1790 into the Middleway area. And he took up a large portion of land on the east bank of the Opequon, immediately south of what is now State Road 51, and north of the road that was then the main road through the area, Bunker Hill Road. Everything begins with a stranger asking for lodging at the Livingstones. The inns in the town were full, and he was on his way probably to Martinsburg, and he needed some lodging. So he stopped at the Livingstones. Some say he was just there for one night. Some say he was there for several nights. And during this time, the Livingstones never discovered what his name was, and they never discovered exactly who he was and what he did and where he was going and where he was from. So he remained a mystery man, although they conversed with him quite a bit. During the night, one of the nights that he was there, the last night he was there, this gentleman fell ill and asked for a priest. And Mrs. Livingston, being a staunch Lutheran and her husband being equally staunch, said, "No Romanist priests in my house," and forbade her husband to go looking for a local Catholic priest. And of course, since these were itinerant priests at the time, that would have been very difficult to find one on the fly anyway. So the gentleman next morning was dead. A whole series of manifestations began to happen. Ducks and geese would be walking along and all their legs would fall off. Or chickens would be out in the yard and the heads would be chopped off as if by a scythe sweeping through the air. People would come into the house and their clothes would be cut as if somebody was using a large pair of scissors. And the sound of scissors and shears through the house was something that marked it. And it was well documented. People noted, you know, you don't keep something quiet like that around a small place like this. So at this point, Mr. Livingston was quite beside himself, of course. This went on for several months. And he started looking around for a minister, since he was Lutheran, who could help him in this, because he came to the conclusion after reading the Bible that this was a diabolical series of exercises. And none of them were able to help him. Some of them came and prayed and read with him, but all this still continued on. At this point, Mr. Livingston had a dream. And in the dream, it showed somebody wearing robes who was chanting. And he believed that that person in that dream was the person who could help him. So first of all, he went to Winchester to an Episcopal priest there, because Episcopal priests wore robes. The Episcopal priest wasn't able to help him. So then he came back and met with a family called McSherry, who were the local Catholics' family. They lived just outside Leetown, which is about 4 or 5 miles to the north of here. And McSherry said, "You need to talk to the priest up in Shepherdstown. We have a service there next week. The visiting priest is coming, and there'll be a service in a house in Shepherdstown. And so he went. And when he walked in, he saw the priest in his robes, and he said, "That's the man in my dream." And he asked the priest if he would come to Middleway and do an exorcism of the house. What we do know is that the priest that Mr. Livingston went to see in Shepherdstown, the Father Dennis Cahill, was in fact visiting there, and he did come down. And the first time he came down, he said a few prayers and sprinkled some holy water around, and everything quietened down for several days. He then came back when the emanations began again and proceeded to conduct a mass on the site, and also proceeded to go over the property with Mr. Livingston and identify the various graves that were there on the property, because there were graves on the property, and created a consecrated graveyard. So at that point, all the hauntings ended.
That was Peter Fricka telling the legend of Wizard Clip. Thanks to Liz McCormick for her help producing that story. Do you know the book The Telltale Lilac Bush? Many people in West Virginia grew up reading the ghost tales from this iconic book. If you did, you'll remember the bright orange cover with the skeleton laughing on it. We recently posted an image of the book's cover on our Facebook page and heard from a number of you that even just seeing it again brought back goosebump-inducing memories. For this next story, we're going to hear one of the stories recorded in this book, which was compiled by folklorist Ruth Ann Music. The story takes place in coal camps in Granttown, West Virginia, where at one time the Federal Coal and Coke Company operated the largest underground coal mine in the world. Folklorist Ruth Ann Music said, "The dark passageways of the coal mines are likely places for ghosts. By and large, they are friendly souls, neither violent nor malevolent, who come back to see how things are getting along and to lend a helping hand when needed." Another folklorist, Judy Byers, knew Ruth Ann Music, and here's one of her favorite ghost stories that Music recorded called Big John's Ghost.
Jim Clyburn said that my grandfather was a coal miner all of his life. He had started to work in the coal mines of Wales when he was only 11 years old. He told me many of his experiences in the mines, and some of which Jim found quite hard to believe, but there was one tale that stood out. And this is the tale that will comprise Big John's ghost. It was about a big Russian coal miner and an accident that took place when the Grandtown mine was just getting started. Now, Grandpa called him Big John because that's what all the other men called him. Well, Grandpa worked with Big John all day. John would plant the charges to blow out the coal, and Jim said Grandpa would fix the plunger. Well, one day, John was planting the dynamite in a vein of coal, and Grandpa was around the corner fixing the plunger that detonated the charge. Well, all of a sudden, he heard an explosion and a terrible scream, and he ran around the corner to find Big John lying on the ground with his head completely blown off. A stick of dynamite had accidentally gone off. Well, it was a terrible shock to Grandpa, Jim said, for he and John had become close friends. And it seemed as if, as he looked down and didn't know what to do to help him, that he almost could hear John talking and laughing. And that's what he remembered. Now he was gone. Well, as the story goes, one foggy morning, just about a month after the accident, Grandpa was going down in the cage alone, the cage that he and Big John had occupied together when they went down to do their special work with that fire in the hole technique. All of a sudden, Grandpa felt as if he were not alone. He slowly turned around, and there before his eyes stood Big John. But he was holding his head under his left arm. And the head was laughing, smiling, and it spoke to Grandpa. Just did it always did when it was on Big John's shoulders. Well, Grandpa shut his eyes, rubbed his eyes, and kept them shut until that cage hit the bottom. When he opened them again, Big John was gone. Well, Grandpa told that story to all the other miners back in that area. And he told it up on land. He told it so often that after a while, people were a little uncomfortable and they didn't really want him to talk about it anymore. Well, in the archives here at the Folklife Center, where we keep Ruth Ann Music's holdings of all these wonderful, wonderful tales, there's a version of this. It's really actually a variant, an addition. And it didn't get put in the story, but I've always been fascinated by it. And in that addition, that variant, it is said that it was a couple of months then after the initial explosion and after Jim's grandfather had this encounter, that a group of miners went down into that area to work. And while they were detonating, taking out the coal, piling it, all of a sudden, there was an explosion. It was more of a landslide. Boom! And this particular group of miners was trapped behind the coal. Now, they figured they knew exactly where they were, and they knew to a certain point how far back the portal vein went. But still, they were trapped. Next, the story goes, some started praying. Some reached into those lunch buckets and the pepperoni buns were already gone. But the pieces of pie and cake were still there, for every miner wanted to take those desserts back home to their young'uns, and when the miners did, that meant another day of not an accident, and the sweet was so good for the children. So some started doing that. Others began to cry. But in the midst of all of that, there was probably more praying. And as the time went by, one man, and then another, for there were about 9 of them, they noticed a winking of a light. But the light was kind of oozing underneath the stack of coal and debris. And then they heard a chuckle. And then they heard a laugh. And by golly, it was the voice, that broken English of that big Russian miner. And as they looked around, that light spread out from under that pile of coal. And standing before them was Big John, with the head laughing, tucked under the left arm. Well, the miner said, "John, can you help us? Can you help us? We're trapped. We're trapped." Well, in his right hand was a lantern, and it spread that light all the way around. And he said, "Follow. Follow me." And they didn't think there was anywhere to go, but somehow there was an opening. out beyond that coal pile. And they followed him. And lo and behold, they came to where the cage was. And they all scrambled in that cage, really too many for one cage, but they were going in it. And it is said, as they saw John put down the lantern, reached up, pulled down the chain, and the cage went up. Now that's what those men told everyone waiting there at the top. Because, you see, the men at the top and even the wives knew there had been a bit of an explosion down underneath, and they feared for their lives.
That was Judy Byers, founding director of the Frank and Jane Gaber West Virginia Folklife Center and professor emeritus of folklore studies at Fairmont State University, telling the tale of Big John's Ghost, a story which was originally written down by Ruth Ann Music for her book, The Telltale Lilac Butch, which was published in 1965. On this show, we heard creepy, spooky, and some unexplainable stories from Appalachia. We try to produce one of these shows every year, and it's usually one of our most popular episodes, perhaps because we've all had those unexplainable, sometimes terrifying moments. That's how storyteller and playwright Dan Cady put it.
I think it's a folktale kind of thing. I think that there are moments in all of these stories that have happened to an awful lot of people that people relate to, even if it's just deja vu, even or it's seeing something out of the corner of your eye that when you look it isn't there anymore, but you can't explain what you saw. Those are universal experiences, and so to incorporate them into a story and be able to retell that story makes those stories very attractive and very relatable, and they're fun. You know, it's fun to get scared.
I watched a few scary movies as a kid. Child's Play with that Chucky doll made me afraid to go to sleep for weeks. It scared the daylights out of me just to glance over and see my dolls wide-eyed at night. I hated that feeling. I can also remember the last time I went to a haunted house. I was probably in middle school and made my family friend carry me out of the house while I screamed. I haven't really had a desire to go back ever since. But I have watched a few scary movies at the request of my friends. It didn't affect me like it did as a kid, but here lately I wish it did. There's just something about getting scared that makes me feel alive. And perhaps that's also the attraction of these stories. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the West Virginia Folklife Program, a project of the West Virginia Humanities Council. Music in today's show was provided by Michael Hurley, Parvis Decree, and The Soaked Lamb. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Molly Bourne is our web editor. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia or send an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. You can also mail a letter to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories at wvpublic.org, and you can find Inside Appalachia on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs, to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.